Many of you would have looked at that totally shambolic telecast of the Live 8 concert last night, principally from Hyde Park. And the duty director who was doing the daytime shoot became strangely obsessed with a couple of girls in the audience who were very amply busted. One of them who had on patriotic Union Jack brassiere. And he kept coming back and back and back and back to that woman. Now, no Gladys of any gender would have looked. I mean, I just kept averting my eyes constantly. And what did I see in the distance? There, over there on the right, gyrating, was, yes, B. Campbell. B. Campbell was there, and she was behaving like a 15-year-old. And she was obviously having... She's going to drop in shortly and give us her review of the concert. But I noticed that the only time she wasn't looking radiantly happy was when there were brief images of Beau Blair writ large on that huge stage screen when you could see her blowing raspberries. B will give us her review shortly. Now let's whiz off to the Northern Hemisphere to speak to our theatre critic, Beatrix Campbell, who's going to tell us about the concert. I thought you looked great in the audience there, B.
Oh, I'm so pleased that you noticed. There was me, you know, texting everybody on my little mobile, which, of course, you can do. And I just didn't know that you noticed or cared.
So oh, I did. Well, I noticed and care. The thing that I wanted to know was how far away were the Portaloos?
Well, because we were quite near the back, they were very near.
Now, what did you make of it? What did you make of it? Was it great and wonderful and an unalloyed joy?
You hear the sound of breathing as I'm trying to think. It was an event, and indeed a whole weekend, full of marvels and paradoxes, and at the centre of it, something which is both a mighty phenomenon in Britain now, and yet curiously mute. And it was the same experience at the concert itself, which was absolutely huge. It was so huge. And involved a level of organisational flair that was in itself spectacular and breathtaking. But, and there are many, many buts, there was a kind of odd will to enthusiasm that didn't find anywhere quite to express itself, except when, you know, a particular band came up that you adore, or a moment that was, you know, sweetly eloquent. For me, those two moments were the very lovely Annie Lennox, who sang to the movie about Aid that was segged into her bit, and the most eloquent of all, one of the very few black performers, Ms. Dynamite, who's a great young British black performer, who was virtually the only performer who really had something novel to say about the cause. And she expressed it very poignantly when she said, here we are to make sure that Africa's debts are relieved. Actually, we are the ones who owe a great debt to Africa. We've plundered, tortured and marauded our way around this place. We are the indebted ones. But those moments were few and far between. And I must say that we later learned that the little films which punctuated all of the performances and which were eloquent, full of facts and articulated the Live 8 and Make Poverty History movement manifesto, they were actually excised, can you believe this, from the BBC's day-long recording of the whole event. So what the watchers at home got, and I know loads of people who just kind of gave up their day to watching it, what they got were celebrity trash interviews, like, what does it feel like, you know, listening to this band, Brian? Mm. What does it feel like being here, Brian? Ridiculous. So it was an extraordinary achievement, and at the same time had a curious kind of muteness at the centre of it. And that points to, more than anything, I think, some of the political contradictions into which this whole movement has come to rest.
Yeah, I was. We only saw a sort of truncated, edited-down version.
Sure.
In Australia, but I was quite touched, despite one's scepticism, even cynicism, in many on you know, public, what can one describe it as, sort of turbocharged emotionalism, when mm-hmm. Sir Bob, or rather Saint Bob, brought out that astonishingly beautiful young woman who had mm-hmm. 20 years ago had been within minutes of death, you know, from starvation, and who's now passed her, what was it, her examination in agricultural affairs or something. That was that was heart-stopping.
It is heart-stopping, and that points to something which I think a sort of a prevailing wind of cynicism doesn't actually answer about the whole Live Aid movement. Bear in mind that at the level of detailed, organised, oppositional politics, Britain is in lots of ways a becalmed place. And at the same time, it's a place where expressions of the collective will and collective feeling about these sorts of issues become very passionate, and they in lots of ways define aspects of popular culture, even though they don't define and don't animate political culture. So you've got a generation of people whose adult lives have been lived with Live Aid, who remember the first Live Aid, who donate bits of their salaries. All of my young relatives actually are people who, if they're in work, habitually connect with these sorts of movements. And these are not people who necessarily sign up to the Socialist Workers' Party. So there is something about these movements as part of the stream of consciousness of British society, which has yet to find an adequate political articulation. And this is expressed in another paradox of this week. Tony Blair and Gordon Brown are hosting the G8 summit. It is taking place in a sequestered fortification, very beautiful, way up north in Gleneagles in Scotland. It couldn't have been more perfectly chosen as a place that you can't get at. And even if you could, the opportunity for barricading the place against the demonstrators is infinite. And so at the same time as the concert was happening, there was a huge demonstration in Edinburgh. 150,000 people turned up at Edinburgh, and indeed many people at both events were texting each other with messages about what it felt like to be on either of them. And these are people who are presenting their manifesto to the 8 most powerful men in the world, in the hope that it's not just aid that will be addressed, but all of the other issues in the Make Poverty History manifesto. Because it's clear that the... And I think this is, again, this is resonant when you think about the young woman that Geldof presented to the multitudes. People have become very literate about aid. They've become very literate about the arms trade. They've become very literate about the way in which the global economy has been invigilated by institutions, international institutions, that are not subject to any democratic will and have been the agents of precisely the kind of thing that has squandered all of that Live Aid resourcefulness, the IMF, the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. And it means that the kind of debate that we have, certainly in Britain at the moment, it feels oddly uneven because people are interested in and focused on the detail of those difficulties, the way in which the world is being administered by those unaccountable bodies and what the effects...
Well, B, if that's the case, we must congratulate Great Britain. And in a sense, it's an extension of what you and I were talking about during the election, when the John Howard type campaign didn't work for Michael Howard. You know, that there seems to be a more sophisticated public opinion process in the UK.
Well, there is. And the difficulty is how that feeling translates from the mood in people's hearts to the intelligence of the NGOs and aid organisations like ActionAid, ChristianAid, Oxfam, Care International, who really provide the kind of collective intelligence and organisation that is moving the Make Poverty Action movement, and to which the government, at least to its credit, is having to say, yeah, we have to listen and we are affected by all of this. But there is no... The work of translation really doesn't happen at the level that it clearly matters amongst those 8 men representing the richest countries in the world. And people are increasingly sensitised and dismayed by the chasm between those two conversations.
How did you react, and how did the crowd in general react to the appearance of Bill Gates?
What an interesting question. Well, we got up off our kind of picnics and had a look to witness the peculiarity of this man with one of the worst haircuts in the world uttering banal benevolences. And there was a kind of odd flatness. You know, it doesn't matter what comes out of the mouth of Nelson Mandela, people will be up on their feet cheering. They weren't, actually. And I think that was partly because of a charisma bypass, but partly also because there is a contradiction in the spectacular accumulation of this wealth and the way in which it exercises itself and the benevolence that is associated with Bill Gates as one of the world's biggest, if not the biggest philanthropist in the world.
And I raised the case of Gates because our version of the concert was depoliticised to make room for thousands of commercials for Kerry Packer. There were absolutely no political statements. I mean, there was virtually nothing, and I only hope that some of the performers didn't follow Geldorf's advice and actually got stuck into the G8ers.
Well, as I said, Ms. Dynamite was just about the only performer who found a kind of poetic, polemical elegance that really was, it was tough, it was unyielding about what the politics of this are about.
Bea, we've got to go, because David Reef is now picking up the story for us, but wonderful to talk to you, and I did see you, darling, I promise, there you were, up at the back near the Portaloos, on the right, is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, good on
the left.
On the left. Well, I mean but stage right. Bea Campbell, journalist, author, social commentator, and, of course, concert reviewer for Late Night Live on Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and, of course, now being downloaded onto a plethora of pods coming up. David Reef on the theme of dangerous pity.